Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon, Pacific's daylight time. And if you would like to be on the program during the live broadcast, we have lines open for you. If you have a question about the Bible or about anything related to the Bible or Christianity, or you would like to revisit a topic that's come up before on the program, particularly if on the previous occasion this host gave an answer to a question that you did not agree with. That is, if you have a difference of opinion about some matter of controversy and would like to balance comment, would like to present the opposite view, you're welcome to do that here. Always welcome to do that on this program. The number to call if you'd like to be on the program is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Our first caller today is calling from Indianapolis, and it's Josh. Josh, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Steve, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
I have a couple of quick questions, but I don't know how much time you have, but one was just a question from Mark chapter 3.
Uh-huh.
In Mark chapter 3, Jesus meets a man with a withered hand, and he sees these Pharisees. He brings him into the, bring this man into the temple. And my question is with regard to Jewish customs in the synagogue. I'm curious to know, and I haven't been able to find the answer, if a man with a withered hand or any crippled or paralyzed man was ever really allowed in the synagogue, or if that would have been another red flag that when Jesus saw these Pharisees coming in who were obviously enemies of his, that when he also noticed this unusual sight with a man with a withered hand, if that would have been a red flag for him that something was going on, if they were up to something. And I just didn't know if you were aware of anything that with Jewish customs with regard to the synagogue, if in fact crippled people were not allowed into the synagogue.
You know, I don't know what the Jewish custom was. I know what the law said. Or disabled in some significant way was not to come into the tabernacle, that is, into the, later on would be the temple. That would be somewhat different than the synagogue, because when the law was given, there were no synagogues. They only had the tabernacle back then, and the synagogue was the temple. The temple replaced the tabernacle, and so in the time of Jesus, those restrictions that the law said, you know, certain people cannot come into the tabernacle, those would have applied to entering the temple in Jerusalem. Now, every Jewish city and every Gentile city that had more than 10 adult male Jews had a synagogue, which was simply a Sabbath meeting place for the Jews in the town. And it was not the temple, and it wasn't conducted like the temple. And I don't know if they had similar rules for that. I doubt that they had similar rules for that. I assume that that the people who could not come into the temple because of a birth defect or something like that, I think they would not be excluded from the synagogue. The synagogue was primarily just a meeting for worship, that is, for prayer and for teaching. And the temple was more of a central shrine for the whole religion of the nation, and a place where sacrifices were offered, and it was a very different kind of situation. Now, it's possible, of course, and it would not be unreasonable for them to apply the same rules of admittance to the synagogue as they would to the temple. But I don't know that they did that. And so I'm not sure whether Jesus would have, when he saw a man with a withered hand, would have immediately thought, uh-oh, someone's going to try to, you know, test me here to see if I'm going to heal this guy. Because it's an interesting question, but I don't know the answer as far as Jewish custom goes. The law itself would not forbid the man from being in the synagogue, because the law, again, didn't address the synagogue at all.
Well, when in Acts, you know, when Peter and John are about to go into the temple and they're outside of the gate beautiful, and then there's the man, the crippled man that they heal prior to going into it.
Uh-huh.
Was he not allowed to go into the temple, or is that just he happened to be outside of the temple when it happened?
Well, I don't I don't know if he was not allowed to go into the temple. He probably was not because he was lame. But the fact is he was out there begging. He wouldn't be begging in the temple even if he had access to the temple.
Can I ask another quick question? Can I ask another quick question?
Sure, go ahead. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry. In Mark chapter 5, when the woman is healed from the hemorrhage, she seems to, in verse 28, display an amazing amount of faith by just saying that if she will touch Jesus' cloak, that she'll become well.
Uh-huh.
Do you know where she might have got thinking from? Or was there any account in the Old Testament with a prophet using clothing to heal or any other sort of thing where she may have got that from? I know at the end of Mark chapter 6, the disciples used, Jesus, it says that he, as he went from city to city, that he was able to heal people and that they would lay people along the side of the road, and if he would just touch them with his cloak or a garment or anything like that, that they would be healed. But do we know of anything prior to that healing of the woman that where she might have been from, or was that just an incredible display of faith?
Well, Jesus saw it as an incredible display of faith, so she might have just had this as a conviction that arose within her that Jesus was so powerful that if she just touched his clothes, she'd get what she needed. However, there were Old Testament precedents for items that had come into physical contact with a prophet being used for the purpose of working miracles. For example, Elisha sent his staff ahead of him when a young boy had died, and he wanted to heal him. He sent his servant ahead of him with his staff to lay it on the boy's body. In this case, the boy didn't rise until Elisha got there and laid his own body over him. But apparently the prophet thought that laying the staff on him might do something, which suggests that perhaps that was a given or a commonly understood thing, that if an anointed man had some object that had been, in contact with him, that it might carry miraculous working power. After Elisha had died, a dead body came into contact with his bones, and the contact with his bones caused the body to spring back to life. That's told in 2 Kings chapter 13. And then, of course, in the book of Acts, which was later than the time you're asking about, there were handkerchiefs and aprons taken from Paul's body, and people were healed when they received them. So both before and after the story you're asking about, there was some precedent. And there was some following episodes that would indicate that maybe it was in the Jewish mind or maybe it was just something they knew God sometimes did, was that having contact with something that had contact with the man of God might have some of his power associated with it and do the miracle. I don't know what this woman had heard. I don't know what her, what informed her about that.
Okay.
But, you read in Acts chapter 5 that people laid their sick along the streets so that Peter's shadow would pass over them and they'd be healed. I don't know who told them to do that. We don't have any reason to believe the apostles told them to do that. And how they, how people assumed that would do anything, I don't know. But it worked. So I guess maybe this mentality was not too uncommon in Israel.
Huh. Okay. Well, that helps out a great deal. They were just a couple of curiosity questions I had. Thank you so much for your time, and I appreciate your ministry, Steve.
Okay, Josh, thanks for your call.
And God bless you.
God bless you, too. Bye now.
Bye.
We're going to take Ike's call, and I understand that my equipment, I'm doing a remote broadcast. I'm not in the studio. My equipment that connects me to the studio, our signal has degraded quite a bit, and I'm going to try to reconnect. I'm going to take Ike's call first because he's been waiting a long time, and when we've done that, I'm going to have my call screener play the theme music for a moment while I try to reconnect our equipment, so be prepared for that. But let's talk to Ike from Portland, Oregon. Hello, Ike.
Hey. Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
Good.
Hey, my question for you is whenever Jesus was walking after the resurrection, whenever he appeared to disciples, and then later on he appeared to Thomas and showed him his hands, so he had the wound scars.
Yeah.
So he had the same physical body, and I understand it's a physical resurrection. So since he was in the same physical body with scars, how come the other disciples did not recognize him?
That's interesting, because on a number of occasions, people didn't immediately recognize him who had known him before. Mary Magdalene was the first to see him after his resurrection, and she didn't immediately recognize him. And then there were the two men on the road to Emmaus walking with him, and they didn't recognize him in apparently several hours of walking and talking with him. And then when they sat to eat with him and he broke the bread, suddenly he was recognizable to them. And likewise in John chapter 21, when the disciples meet Jesus on the shore when they've been fishing, John recognizes Jesus, but not from his looks. He recognizes Jesus when Jesus works a miracle that he recognizes as being like a previous miracle Jesus had worked. And when the disciples meet with Jesus on the shore, it says there none of them dared to ask him who he was because they knew it was him. But that's interesting that it words it that way. None of them dared to ask him who he was. It almost sounds like they would like to have asked him who he was, but they didn't dare because they knew who he was. And that's a very strange statement. And my impression is that you're right, that his body that came out of the grave was the same person, still had the marks of the nails and so forth in the body. But there must have been something different about his appearance. I mean, some people have pictured it that he, you know, had his head covered over and was, you know, keeping his face in the shadows or something until a certain point when he revealed who he was to people. That's a possibility. But it's also possible that in his resurrected form he had some different features. His same body may have taken on a different form in some ways. After all, his body had been fairly mutilated during the crucifixion. And even his face had been, you know, had hair torn out of it, and you know, it says his visage, his face was marred more than any man. It's possible that they didn't recognize him because he still bore all of those scars, or it may be that you know, those scars were healed up and he looked somewhat different. Because I really don't know, but I've asked myself the same question many times, because there's several of the Gospels make reference to this very thing, that when the disciples saw him, it was him, and they, you know, but they didn't initially recognize him because he looked somewhat different. But
I don't know way to really know that whether or not he was physically healed from all his wounds except for the nail prints, because it doesn't really, because they didn't say anything about the whippings or lashings or anything like that.
Right. I don't think there's any statement of scripture. There's no statement of scripture that tells us he was healed up from those things.
Yeah. Just so I guess it's one of those answers that aren't there or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of, we know what the Gospels tell us, and what they don't tell us, we don't know, you know?
Yeah.
And same thing with some of the questions that the last caller asked from the Gospels. You know, there's things the Gospels tell us. And there's some things people know from studying Jewish history, but there's other things we just don't know, and we can't get it from the Gospels or other sources available to us.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out one day, so I'm cool with that.
Yeah, so we just have to conjecture about that.
Well, I appreciate it. And by the way, I got on your website, and I've been listening to the spiritual warfare one about the origins of Satan, and that was really eye-opening for me. So I appreciate that, and that's an amazing set of tools you have that are available on the internet.
Well, we got hundreds of them, hundreds of lectures on MP3, and I'm glad you've discovered them and that they're benefiting you.
Yeah, they are. So God bless you. Thanks again.
Thanks, Ike. God bless you. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
We have another caller from Portland, but we're going to take just about a minute, and I'm going to try to reconnect my equipment, because I imagine my voice doesn't sound very clear right now because my equipment is hooked up at a very poor transfer rate. So I'm going to take 1 minute break. You'll just be listening to our theme music, and I'll be back. We'll talk to Keith and other callers. Stay tuned. I'll be right back. We're reconnected. Thanks for staying tuned. This is Steve Gregg. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We're going to talk to Keith from Portland next, and if you'd like to be on the program, we have lines open for you at this number, 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090 if you'd like to be on the show today. Let's talk to Keith from Portland. Hi, Keith. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm going to have to take your answer off the air. I'm driving at the moment.
Okay.
But I was curious as to what you thought of the George Lanza translation of the Prosciutto. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yeah,
I know a little about him and the translation. I know some people like it and some people are real crazy about it. So I was just kind of wondering what your take on the translation was.
Okay, and you don't want to stay on the line because you're driving, right?
Yeah, I'm coming back down I-5 out of Washington, so. But, that was the only question I had, so.
Okay, right, I appreciate your call.
All right, thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Keith. Bye-bye now.
God bless.
Yeah. Well, Lanza's translation of the Peshitta is actually based on the assumption that the New Testament was originally written in Aramaic, and that the Greek New Testament, which is what almost all of our Bible translations used, that wasn't the original, that the apostles and Jesus spoke in Aramaic is almost certain, at least during their Palestinian times. But it is sometimes argued that they also wrote their, you know, the books of the New Testament in Aramaic. And the Syriac churches, I believe, have preserved an Aramaic version of the New Testament. And Lanza, I believe, is from, I've read of the man in the past, it slips my mind some of the details, but he's from the Eastern Church. He's from the Syriac Church himself, I believe, and he made a translation in English using the Aramaic New Testament. And a lot of people, including some people I know, even in ministry, have felt that, you know, they've got a better New Testament when they've got one that's translated right from the Aramaic, which Jesus spoke and the apostles spoke. But I seriously doubt that the New Testament was originally written in Aramaic. We do know that Matthew wrote some kind of a document in Aramaic because Papias, a church father who lived at the end of the first century, mentions that Matthew wrote the sayings of Jesus in Aramaic. And then other people, it says, translated them as best they could, presumably into Greek. There's no reason to believe that any of the other books of the New Testament were written in Aramaic originally. It's true, there is an Aramaic New Testament. There's also the New Testament in many languages. The question is, what was the original language it was written in? And it would seem that Greek would be the language. Because, I mean, think about it. Even though in Palestine, the Jews did speak Aramaic, hardly any of the books of the New Testament were written to people who lived in Palestine. Most of them were written to Gentiles who wouldn't know a thing about Aramaic. I mean, the book of Romans, although it was written to a mixed group of Jews and Gentiles, certainly in Rome, Aramaic was not widely spoken, certainly not by the Gentiles, and probably not really by the Jews there either. It was mainly a Palestinian Jewish dialect that was used, and so the Jews whose ancestors had been in Rome for generations probably would not be speaking Aramaic, but everyone knew Greek. Everyone in the whole Mediterranean world knew Greek. When you look at letters like the ones that Paul wrote to Thessalonica and to Corinth, that's four of his epistles. Those are Greek cities. And the letters we have from him are in Greek. And almost certainly, are the original language he wrote it in. Why would he write to these Gentiles in Aramaic? It doesn't seem likely that he would. And the oldest manuscripts we have of the New Testament, I believe, are the Greek manuscripts. And therefore, I don't share the assumption that George Lanza makes that Aramaic is the original language of the New Testament. And I don't share that assumption when it's held by other people who like to use the Lanza translation. Now, I'm not opposed to George Lanza's translation. I've never used it. I haven't read it. I can't critique it. I have read other people's critiques of it a long time ago. I don't remember specifically what they objected to or not. All I know is that the reason I haven't read it is because I have other good English translations of the Bible that I use on a regular basis. I don't need one that's translated from the Aramaic, because as near as I can tell, that's like taking, you know, a translation and making another translation from the translation. That is to say, some of the first English Bibles were translated, for example, from the Latin. Wycliffe and some of the early Bible translators translated portions of the Bible from Latin into English. But the Latin was not the original language. The Latin was a translation that had been made by Jerome from the Greek. So you've got, you know, those English translations were third generation translations. It was written in Greek, then in translating to Latin, and then from the Latin into English. Well, why translate from the Latin into English when you can translate directly from the Greek into English? And that's what, of course, all modern translations do. They translate directly from the Greek into the English. They don't, you know, they bypass the Latin altogether. And I feel that the Lanza translation is making the same mistake of he's translating into English from a translation, not from the original. I believe the Greek was the original language of the New Testament. And the Aramaic Bible was translated from it, as I believe. That cannot be proven, and that's why I gave you some reasons that I would be influenced by. I think that it's very unlikely that Paul wrote Aramaic, you know, correspondence to Greek and Roman people who don't speak that language. I mean, most of Paul's churches were Gentile churches, and not even all the Jews in the Roman world spoke Aramaic. It was mainly the Palestinian Jews. So it doesn't make an awful lot of sense to suggest that those were written in Aramaic originally. But the Gospels, I can see why someone might say that they were, but I don't think they were. I believe that Mark was written in Rome, and that you know, John was written in Ephesus, and these were not Aramaic-speaking places, and they were not written to Aramaic-speaking audiences. Why would they write in Aramaic? And from time to time, you do find in the Greek New Testament, you do find some Aramaic words, as if the writers wanted to retain one or two words in the original Aramaic for emphasis. For example, in the Gospels tell us that on the cross Jesus said, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is Aramaic for, my God, why have you forsaken me? Or when he said to the little girl, when he healed her, talitha kumi, which is Aramaic for, little girl, I say unto you, arise. And even Paul in 1 Corinthians interjected an Aramaic word, maranatha, which means our Lord come. So, I mean, there is the insertion of some Aramaic words, which apparently were remembered from the mouth of Jesus or otherwise were significant. But they were inserted into texts that were primarily written in Greek. And I think that the Greek New Testament that we have is the original, and the Aramaic is not. That's my impression of the Lanza translation, or rather the assumptions behind the Lanza translation. All right, we have some lines open for you. We're going to talk next to Bob in Portland, Oregon. But we have lines open for you at this number, 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090 if you have a question or you disagree with the host and would like to state the matter of disagreement that you have. All right, 1-800-438-5090. Bob from Portland, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Thank you.
Hi.
Steve. You know, in Psalm 22 is Jesus dying on the cross. I understand that was written in Aramaic. And
Psalm 22? The Psalms were written in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean that one Psalm in 22 was written in Aramaic, I understand.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know that.
I believe it was. Mm-hmm. Check it out. Anyway, when Jesus was talking to Mary Magdalene, he said, "Touch me not, for I have not yet ascended to the Father." So it was my idea that Jesus ascended to heaven prior to the time when they saw him leave the earth. And I think it proves it out here in Daniel 7, starting with the 13th verse, which is a pre-picture of Jesus going to heaven and coming back again to speak to the disciples. In 7:13 it says, "I saw in the night visions, and behold, there came with the clouds of heaven one like unto a son of man, and he came even to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed. And then in Matthew 28:18, Jesus said, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go ye therefore and make disciples of all nations. See? So anyway, I think Jesus ascended to heaven. He was cleansed and returned to earth to visit with the disciples, you know, 40 days after he was raised from the dead, before he ascended into heaven.
Well, you could be right, and I've certainly heard that theory before. I don't know if Daniel 7:13 necessarily proves that point. It certainly, I agree with you that Daniel 7:13 is talking about the ascension of Christ into heaven, whereas many people take that to be a reference to the second coming.
Sure.
But actually, where it says, I saw this one like the Son of Man coming to the Ancient of Days, it's obviously he's leaving earth and coming to heaven rather than going the other way. So this is not a passage about the second coming. It's a passage about Jesus' ascension. But the question of whether he ascended as per Daniel 7:13 before he saw the disciples on Resurrection Sunday or not, that's entirely based, I think, on the fact that Jesus said to Mary Magdalene, do not touch me, for I've not yet ascended to my Father. And yet, a few minutes later, he allowed other women to touch him, to hold his feet and to worship him, and he invited the disciples to touch him and feel him and see that he was physical and not spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that he said, do not touch me, to Mary Magdalene, has caused some people to say, well, why didn't he let her touch him when he let others touch him shortly afterwards? And when he says, I have not yet ascended to heaven, some have understood it, as you do, to say, well, he had to not be touched until he had gone to heaven and come back, and then he could be touched.
Mm-hmm.
But my understanding of the words he spoke to Mary Magdalene are somewhat different, because the word touch that is used, or the Greek word, is hapto. And hapto can mean a number of things, but it often means, in fact, most often I think it means, to cling to. Don't cling to me, is what he was saying, I think. So I don't think he was necessarily saying he couldn't be touched because he had to go to heaven first and then he could afterwards be touched. I think what he was saying to Mary is, don't cling to me because I have yet to leave again. I'm going to ascend to my Father. And in my opinion, that ascension he's referring to was his final ascension from the Mount of Olives.
Well, and, Steve?
Yes.
He said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And that